Well, hello there. It's the Politics Show. Where's Tony Gosling? Where is Tony Gosling?
He's somewhere in the Pacific Ocean at the moment, I believe.
Okay, right. What, do you mean he's on his way back?
He's on his way back, but I don't know where exactly.
Does that mean he's not listening right now?
That doesn't mean that at all.
Well, hello, it's the Politics Show. I'm Steve Satan. That man there is Martin Summers. And for the final week, we're sitting in for Tony Gosling, who is coming back from his holidays now from New Zealand. Last week, we were all snowed out, so we weren't able to make it. But we're here in a kind of roundabout way this week. But sadly, our guest couldn't make it. We did have Councillor Asher Craig booked. She's citing problems with IT and diary failure for not making it. And to be fair, it was booked like ages ago. She's the Labour member for St George West, as well as being the Deputy Mayor with responsibility for communities and stuff, but she's not here. So it just leaves me and Martin to talk for hours and hours, and God knows we can. We've got enough stuff to talk about. There's a few Bristol-related things, a lot of stuff on the international scene, and a lot of stuff where the UK is interacting with the rest of the world in a way which is very, very significant. Martin, what has caught your eye or ear in the news this week in particular?
Well, I was contacted by Russia Today 2 days ago to talk about the incident in Salisbury, obviously. And, you know, I didn't actually do it because it was not convenient for me to do it.
Well, I wasn't suggesting you poisoned anyone, you know.
No, but I mean, obviously they wanted my, you know, take on what had happened or what the implications of it were and so on.
Yeah.
So that's obviously something I could discuss if that's what we want to discuss.
Well, I think we'll leave that till a little bit later. Yeah. But we'll try and focus a little bit closer to home to start off with. I've got a number of sort of Bristol-related stories that we could or could not talk about. I don't know whether you... Well, certainly when it comes to money and finance, you can talk, can't you?
Well, yeah, I mean, just give me a go and we'll see if there's anything in my files. You
we'll,
know?
We'll push the buttons on Martin Summers and see what he comes up with. The story that caught my eye was the concern Conservative leader on Bristol City Council, that's Mark Weston, and he says he's sort of feeling the pain of Tory cuts, and you know that we in Bristol are really suffering, and we shouldn't really be suffering these cuts, even though he says that he fully supports the government's austerity measures, which is kind of a little bit between two stools, isn't it? What's your
well, I
about?
Think it's more like schizophrenia, isn't it? Really, we wish that, you know, I mean, to be fair, Mark Weston is quite a frequent contributor on this show, and the sort of thing he says is, well, we had to carry out cuts, which I dispute, frankly.
Of course.
But now, of course, it's gone too far, and maybe we shouldn't be cutting certain things. And, of course, this is a problem for Tory politicians in general, which is that the idea of cuts in general is kind of popular, as long as it's not my stuff that's being cut, and at that point suddenly it's not so popular, and then you're caught in a bit of a cleft stick, aren't you?
Yeah, indeed. And of course the problem is then transferred onto the local councils, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's a fairly clear pattern emerging that local government, whoever runs it, feels as if it's being hard done by here. And I think it's pretty clear that just like in the 1980s, but more so, the central government has loaded the cuts onto local government because they're not the local government and they're not going to get the blame for it.
Yeah.
Now, that in a way works because, you know, it's Labour councils in the big cities who end up doing all the nasty stuff. So from a sort of he-he-he sneaky kind of politics point of view, that works. But, of course, it's still the same problem for Tory-run councils in the suburbs. They've got stuff that they want to do and suddenly find that they can't do it. And, you know, local government really has been gutted. So we have all this fuss about whether we're going to have elected mayors or not and who's going to be the elected mayor and whether they're suitable people and all the rest of it. But in actual fact, it's a bit of a farce because the policy that local government's got to pursue has already been set by central government. This isn't a federal setup in Britain, apart from the devolved assemblies and so on. Local government used to have quite a lot of powers. In the 1980s, when Livingstone was head of the GLC, he could put on a business rate on the City of London, make a huge amount of money out of that, and then spend it on anything he wanted, which he did. And, of course, that made him very popular and therefore, unbeatable electorally, which is why they abolished the GLC. But that's no longer true.
Yeah, indeed. One of the examples of that was his Fares Fair policy.
Indeed, although that was knocked down by the courts, if you remember.
Right.
They said, completely ridiculously, this was when the House of Lords was still the supreme judgment, they said, you've got to run it at a profit. And it's like, well, hang on, nobody runs bus systems in a city the size of London at a profit. So it was basically just a way of sabotaging the policy, which was a popular policy. And obviously one of the things that would have got him re-elected if he'd been allowed to stand. I mean, if you think about it, it was pretty undemocratic to abolish all local government for London. At one stage it was completely run by central government just to keep him out. Yeah,
that was outrageous, wasn't it?
It was.
Is there any evidence that you were talking about these cuts affecting councils, including Tory councils? Yeah. Is there any evidence that that Tory councils are suffering less because they've been treated?
Well, yes, because a lot of the standard spending assessments are, you know, quite complicated to decide who gets what. It's based on level of need in the area and so on and so forth. So local government doesn't really raise its own finance except at the margin. Everybody goes on about council tax, which is obviously falls most heavily on poorest people, but nevertheless most of the money that local government spend come from central government based on a standard spending assessment formula. And what the Tory government has done while they've been in power is keep tweaking the formula so that they get more money for their area. So East Dorset has had the least cuts in Britain, and I think Knowle in Liverpool has had the most.
Right.
And that's because they've been tweaking, and that's, you know, that's how it works, and it's pretty brutal.
Yeah, but electorally, you know, from a strategic point of view, aren't they doing it the wrong way around? Because obviously they're as it were, treating the converted favourably, whereas actually you want to swing votes, don't you?
But then the other thing is what you're saying to people in inner city areas, vote Labour if you like and you will suffer the consequences. Whereas if the Tories controlled major urban areas like London, then they would tweak it to make sure that, you know, Boris Johnson did have a few bob to throw around. And of course it's become very, very polarised. Although I think at local government level, there is some solidarity between local authorities, both Tory and Labour, about this, you know, this isn't fair and not reasonable. You know, people who get involved in local politics want to do good things for their community, whatever party they're from. And, you know, closing schools and you know, throwing people out on the street and all the rest of it is not what people went into politics for.
Fine. Okay, now, so we discussed finance. I don't know whether this is something that gets your goat. Bristol business chief wants homeless people banned as terrorists because they could hide devices in their belongings. Have you seen this story?
Well, I did see the story, yeah. But I didn't read it. Who is this individual?
Okay,
what is their authority to speak?
Well, his name is John Hurst, and he's the chief executive of Destination Bristol, and he's also the head of the Broadmead... Broadmead Business Improvement District team.
Yes.
He's written to the county court in support of an injunction to get a homeless couple kicked out of the area. And this couple are called Ramon Longbottom and Laura Andrea. And it looks like, yeah, there's this organisation called Streetwise, a partnership supposedly between Bristol City Council and Avon and Somerset Police. And they want to basically rid them from camping out in Broadmead. And, you know, I mean, it does strike me as it's sort of... it's treating the symptoms rather than treating the problem, isn't it?
Well, I mean, if we're talking about homelessness, then we can have one discussion. But claiming that the homeless are potential terrorists, I think, is a what's that about? I mean, that's what intrigues me. Where's that coming from?
Well, I'm struggling to think of it, but you know, it says they could hide devices in their belongings. I suppose, you know, obviously, if you're homeless,
well, and people could hide devices in their cars. So we should ban cars from Bristol.
it's hard to defend his position, really. I mean, I think, you know, he's clearly from a sort of a business and looking at it from the shopper's point of view.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're running Cabot Circus, you don't want a load of homeless people hanging around begging off people and just, you know, cluttering the place up and, you know, just creating the wrong vibe for people to open their wallets. But I'm afraid homeless people have to go somewhere.
Yeah.
It's just a fact.
Yeah.
Unless they're going to die and then they go to the cemetery or whatever, then they're going to have to go somewhere and somebody's going to have to deal with it. And of course, there's always been homeless people on the streets, ever, or, you know, all my lifetime, but there's never been as many young homeless people as there used to be. As I mean, when I was in my teens, there were homeless people, but they were middle-aged guys, usually with drink problems.
You're sort of traditional sort of tramp type character.
Absolutely. Yeah. Whereas, of course, when they withdrew, I remember when they withdrew housing benefit and unemployment benefit from 16 to 18-year-olds. And they said, well, the families have got to look after them. And, of course, many people haven't got families that can or will look after them. They came out of care and they ended up on the streets for two years with no financial support. And that was the rot set in there, really. And, of course, there's a big increase in people sleeping in the streets and in measured homelessness since this particular government came to power a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, whatever it is. And that's because of the universal rules in universal credit, which we've discussed on the show before, where private landlords won't rent to people on universal credit, which has been absolutely clear from the get-go. But, of course, it means that when you roll universal credit out, rent arrears immediately shoot up and people get evicted. And also, in any case, private landlords won't rent to people who they think are going to be on universal credit because they feel that they're going to fall into rent arrears. Yeah. And this is a fundamental problem with the universal credit. And it's typical of the government that they've had loads of feedback from everybody saying, well, this isn't going to work for the reasons that are pretty obvious, but they won't back down on it because it's all part of reforming people's behaviour to make them good little consumers and citizens, and they've got to manage their own budget, etc. Even if they've got mental health issues, a heroin problem or whatever, they're going to pay their rent. Yeah. And if they can't pay their rent, then they'll sleep in the street and that will teach them. And it's just stupid.
There was controversy a couple of months ago about this 6 week delay between.
Absolutely.
Have they backed down on that?
Well, no, they've reduced it to 5 weeks.
Okay.
But of course, the point is that people who have got no money, when they come forward to ask for money, it's because they haven't got any.
Yeah, yeah.
And therefore, what happens is they then go through several weeks of not being able to pay the rent. Now, in theory, they can pay the rent that they owe over from their universal credit going forward, yeah? Mm-hmm. But, of course, landlords aren't prepared to put up with that. You fall into a rent arrears for 5 weeks, then they're going to kick you out.
Yeah.
And, of course, what you can do, you can always go to Wonga, or you can go to somebody else that you know, your local drug dealer, and borrow cash. But then, of course, you're in debt.
Yeah.
And this has been the major criticism of universal credit. It's designed by people who are wealthy, basically, and the idea is that everybody's supposed to have a month. You don't get paid once you get it after the 6 week wait. You've then got to wait till your last paycheck, and then you don't get paid till a month after that, and you only get it monthly.
Right.
So we're all learning to be middle class and paid monthly.
Yeah.
Now, in actual fact, the way the labour market works in Britain today, many people are paid weekly or daily, yeah, as they always were.
Yeah.
And, of course, the idea that we're all actually professionals now on monthly salaries is fatuous.
Yeah, yeah. On, like you say, the gig economy and zero-hours contracts and all that sort of thing.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, a lot of the universal credit problems is simply because Ian Duncan Smith saw it as a means to discipline the underclass, and he won't back down on these aspects of it, and the Tory Party won't back down because they'll have to admit that it was wrong to think of it in those terms.
Mm.
I mean, a safety net should be a safety net. Poor people should be able to turn up, and if they've got no money and they're on their uppers, they should be immediately helped. And it makes sense to do that. There was an NGO based in Wales which persuaded the Welsh government that you try to stop people becoming homeless. That's the way to save money. Once they're actually on the slippery slope and they're sliding down the drain, then you end up spending far more money on them in the long run than if you just. And in the US, they've pursued these policies of housing first. This person may have a drug, alcohol, mental health issue, but first of all, let's take them off the street and put them somewhere safe, and then we will deal with the issue.
Right. That sounds unusual.
Well, it's common sense, but
but it sounds unusually progressive for the USA.
Well, no, but it's local. It's local authorities in the USA have done this. It's not a general policy. There's certain areas. I think in the various progressive cities, that's the way I think Oklahoma have done it. I can't remember where it was exactly. And, of course, it will be standard practice in other European countries. Because in Britain, there is still the idea that poor people should be seen to suffer, and made to suffer, because that's, you know, it's, that's necessary as part of their moral education and moral education for others,
doesn't it? Yeah. It's already before. We'll move on to transport, and it's timely because just looking at the roadmap here, I've got sort of live action cameras and lots of red lines on the map. The M5 going south is red. The A38 is red. The A4 is red in both directions. The A38 going southbound out of the city is red all the way to all the way beyond Taunton. It's not a great night to be driving. The M4 is mostly okay, except between the M5 and the M32 going eastbound, and I think that's beginning to ease off now. So apologies if you're stuck in traffic. In fact, I took the train in, and that goes over the M32, and I was looking at a whole load of tail lights not going very fast as I came in. Now, but on the subject of transport, Bristol is planning to introduce a congestion charge amongst claims that there are 300 deaths a year linked to pollution and that this is not a war on motorists. Is it a war on motorists, do you think?
Well, I mean, obviously it's been bruited around before, hasn't it? You know, generally it's been resisted by, you know, lots
motorists.
By motorists, yeah. I mean, to do these kind of things, the congestion charge in London was brought in when Livingstone was at the height of his power, really. Not really at the height of his power. We were talking about earlier when he was
in his second phase.
In his second phase, you know, phase two Livingstone. And if you're going to do
2.0,
And of course, that's the sort of thing that you might have expected George Ferguson to push through, but he was just too weak. He just didn't have the political oomph to do it. And I don't know whether it's a good or a bad idea. I think probably it's a good idea, but you only get things like that done in one kind of big splurge. You know, you break the opposition and then bang, it's done. I mean, everybody accepts that the congestion charge in London now, it's just bedded in.
But it's bedded in, and it's interesting, I suppose, that Boris didn't reverse it.
That's right.
But does that necessarily mean that it has actually been a success?
I think if you think about what London would be like without the congestion charge after the years that it's been running, it would have got worse and worse and worse. It's not actually improved anything very much, but at least it's stopped things sliding in that direction. And as you've obviously pointed out many's a time, the real key is to get public transport sorted so that people actually there's actually a positive reason to get out of your car rather than just a negative reason.
Just going back to George Ferguson, you said George Ferguson was too weak to implement it. I'm pretty confident that George Ferguson, if he were still mayor, would be supportive of this scheme or trying to get it through. But he managed to get through the very controversial and strongly opposed residence parking schemes, didn't he?
But although what happened was that he wanted to bring him in to court across the board, and there was such a lot of resistance by some communities that he didn't do that. And what you find now is, you know, there's some parts of Bristol which have got, you know, control parking and other parts haven't. And that's a bit, you know, that's not the case in London, you know. It's all control, that's it.
And it has to be said that there's notably not around the tobacco factory as a parking zone as well.
I mean, people would point things like that out.
You know, I think it's a fair comment, isn't it? You know?
Well, I think the thing in St Paul's, there was a lot of resistance to it, but it was brought in, and I think the residents now, my feeling is that they're actually rather happy with it, because at first they thought, well, why should I pay to park my car? But then suddenly, because it pushed a lot of commuter traffic parking out, they suddenly find, well, actually they can get somewhere to park, and the money they're paying means that they've got the right to park their car in their local community right outside their house, and you know, they don't have to struggle with that.
Yeah, I still hate it. It's made my life worse in Hotwells, and I hate George for it. But anyway, to a lesser extent, the control parking zones and certainly congestion charges are sort of working on a financial penalty for using your car. And I'm wondering whether there are any other ways of changing people's behaviour that don't rely on sort of punishing them in the wallet.
Yeah, well, I think also it's based on a kind of market perception of human nature, isn't it? You know, we just change the financial calculation, and then people will change their behaviour. Well, I think the obvious thing to do is to have decent public transport, which again, where Livingstone was going with his fares fair policy is, why can't you have free buses? Hop on, hop off. Because then you set that. Think how efficient that is. Well, no collection of money, no robberies because there's no money to steal. It just, you know, people just get on and go. And in Seattle, I believe that is what does happen.
Well, they managed it in Sheffield for a while, didn't they, in the
80s? Yes, in the 80s they did, that's right. Yeah. But, of course, that was all, you know, that's it's all killed off. I mean, if you think about it, it's path dependency. If at certain stages in history, and we're now talking, you know, that's, what is it, 30, 40 years ago? If we'd started doing the right things then, then things would be very different than the way they are. But, of course, if you carry on doing the wrong things, then you find yourself in a situation where you can't really do much about it because you've just... You've just messed it up.
Yeah, I mean, okay, looking at the sort of bigger picture, we often look to Europe, and possibly in some cases through slightly sort of rose-tinted spectacles, about how they get it right with transport, which, you know, which is often the case, I think. Certainly, you know, we think of the reliability and efficiency of the Swiss trains and so on, and, you know, the Dutch, I think, have a pretty good reputation. Looking at the sort of bigger picture of the political background that makes it or allows it to happen differently in Europe, what is that?
Well, I mean, in Europe, the idea of collective decision making is not controversial. You know, it's a mainstream. You know, the German industrialists are quite happy to have. You know, state-run railways which get them to their meetings on time, which have to be subsidised a bit. It doesn't bother them.
Right.
Whereas
right.
you've got another... Don't forget, the privatisation of the railways here was the final, last kind of insult to injury kind of thing by the Tory government, the major government. And they managed to push it through because everybody thought that it was bonkers, you know, the poll tax on wheels, don't do it. And it was put off, and they did it at the very last minute, and then we were stuck with it. We're still stuck with it decades later because what we do in Britain is we do the wrong stuff and then we don't learn the lessons from doing the wrong stuff, because if we've changed our minds, we're not going to change them again. It's a bit like Brexit, you know, and it's like a three-year-old mentality.
We might talk about that
once
later,
said we're going to do this, then we're going to do it, and even if it's completely wrong, we're not changing it because that's all, it's done and dusted, we've decided it's going to be this. And it's that kind of there's an inflexibility and a kind of sclerosis in the way the British political system works. It's winner take all for a start. Which is just not normal. In Germany, there's been a lot of huffing and puffing and umming and ahhing about it, but the equivalent of the German Labour Party and the equivalent of the German Tory Party have just formed a coalition. But that's
unthinkable in this country.
Well, it's unthinkable, that's right. Yeah. It's unthinkable, whereas in Germany, it's not unthinkable. It wasn't unthinkable in Austria or Switzerland, for example. For most of the post-war era, you had basically grand coalitions in most German-speaking countries. And that was only possible, really, because the conservatives were more moderate. They were, you know, that certain, you know, socialistical values, like, you know, having a state-run railway, were not controversial. There's nothing to argue about. Everybody agreed that that was the way to do it.
Yeah.
Whereas in this country, ideology trumps common sense frequently, as we were saying about universal credit earlier.
And going back to, if you look at like Heath's government, it seems you know, almost left wing, doesn't it?
Well, it's more left wing than Tony Blair, for sure.
On the subject of Tony Blair and the railways, John Prescott promised that he'd renationalise the railways, and he failed to do it. You know, and he could have done it as is proposed by. The current Labour administration, just simply to allow these franchises to lapse back into public ownership. So it would have cost nothing. Why did Blair's Labour not do it, do you think?
Well, because Blair saw it as an ideological... He's ideological, and he saw it as undermining the neoliberal consensus around which British politics operates. Yeah, that he would be seen to be too left-wing.
Really?
Yes, that's how stupid it all is. Yeah?
You know, on some other issues, Blair was, you know, quite moderately left-wing, wasn't he? Minimum wage and...
The thing is that his whole pitch was that we're not going to change the Thatcherite settlement.
Right.
We are simply going to manage it with a in a more humane way, but we're not going to challenge the fundamentals of it, and that's what he promised, and that's what he did. And of course, what's happened since 2008 and the collapse of the financial services sector is that, you know, common sense has started to bubble up. A majority of Tory voters believe in nationalised railways, and that's a fact.
Yeah.
But don't forget that focus groups and all that sort of stuff only matters when they're telling you what you want to hear. Britain has step by step become a more, I mean, if we go through it to a hard Brexit, Patrick Minford and others are calling for complete deregulation of the British economy, no tariffs on any incoming imports, even if there's tariffs against ours, and we're going to be like a little Singapore off the coast of Europe. And that is the ideological fantasy that these people have.
Yeah.
And, of course, in Singapore, of course, 80% of people live in houses owned by the government, but don't start talking about stuff like that. Because, of course, you can imagine, in Singapore, if they had a free market in real estate, then, you know, a tiny proportion of people would live in penthouse flats and everybody else would sleep in the street.
Yeah,
and, of course, they don't do that.
Yeah. We will come on to Brexit later. I don't want to get into the specifics of Brexit, but no. I do want to get into this idea of, because you just raised it there, divisions which don't go down party lines. And I think there was something in the news recently about, there was a meeting, I don't know whether it's happened or whether it's about to happen, in Bristol, about someone wanting to start a new political party to oppose Brexit.
Yeah.
And so we have things like the nationalisation of the railways, which splits the Tory party, obviously not a big issue. Brexit certainly does split the Tory party. And it splits Labour Party. And, is there, I mean, I don't know what I'm asking, really. You know, is there a way forward for, you know, issues and policies, you know, to avoid party lines and for things to get done? Somehow?
Well, I think one of the problems in Britain is the electoral system. In other parts of Europe, Ireland, for example, as public opinion changes and shifts, it's reflected pretty quickly in the, you know, effects in local elections and so on. And that means everybody takes account of other people's opinions. Because if they're not voting for you today, they might vote for you tomorrow. And they might vote for you as a second preference and so on.
Mm.
Whereas in Britain, because it's a winner-takes-all system, it's all or nothing. Yeah?
Yeah.
So, for example, in terms of the internal struggles in the Labour Party, the left wing are only going to get one crack at this. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're not going to compromise because they're only ever going to get one crack at it.
Yeah.
Now, if it was a different setup and the way the world works was different, then you could have people making deals across party lines. And in actual fact, that's normal in every other country in Europe because they've got proportional systems.
Yeah.
It's not a panacea. You can still have situations where people are so divided that they can't agree, even under a proportional system. But in it's a completely topsy-turvy setup now, and Brexit has brought it all to a head of the constitution. What does a referendum mean? Where does the power really lie? The DUP are propping up the Tory government, even though the six counties voted to stay in the European Union. And the Scots, anything that's done to keep the Irish happy, the Scots say, well, me too. You know, it's a mess, frankly.
Yeah.
And dysfunctional mess.
It is a mess, but we tend to think, don't we, that, you know, focus groups are sort of running policy. And obviously politicians do pay a lot of attention to focus groups because they're, you know, they're telling the politicians what ordinary people think, partly based on what they read in the tabloids, but so on.
Yeah.
It is a representative sample of public opinion. And in that regard, it's fair enough that they...
Well, it is, but what's interesting is they only listen to it when it tells them what they want to hear.
Right, right.
Yeah? So the whole focus group thing, well, that's what people really want. Is only because that's what there are certain things that politicians don't want to hear from people, whatever it is. You know, it depends what their prejudices are, you know. And, the focus groups in the run-up to the Iraq war were pretty clearly saying, let's not get involved in this.
Okay.
But it was overruled. Because there's a power structure behind this.
Mm.
Winning elections is one part of it, and then there's the actual power structure. And the elections are just one feature of that. There's various policies and proposals and stuff, you know, a transatlantic trade investment partnership, which is being negotiated behind closed doors by high-level, you know, bruisers. And that is going on at the same time as we're pretending to care what, you know, Granny Southwell believes about the bypass.
Yeah, but okay, so but, There's no point having focus groups if you're going to completely ignore them, is
there? No, yeah, they have focus groups to try and assess what public opinion is,
yeah.
And then they decide whether to go with it or just ignore it, depending upon what the other interests are that are going on. I mean, NATO did a survey inside Syria about 5 years ago, and then it was leaked. And what it came out, it said, well, about 70% of the population support the government, 15% are massively opposed to the government, and the others don't know. But their own internal survey of Syrian public opinion was that 70% of the population supported the government. Now, of course, they didn't take account of that because they wanted to overthrow that government.
Right.
It was leaked. It wasn't something that they put out there.
Yeah.
Somebody had seen this and said, people need to see this. And, of course, in the media, even now, people go on about Assad this, Assad, he's not particularly a nice man, but net politicians aren't. But the idea that they haven't got the support of the population, NATO's own internal report said they have.
Okay. And you mentioned, just go back to another little throwaway comment you made, Labour has one crack at it. Now, you're talking about...
Well, the left wing of the Labour Party. The left wing of the Labour Party has got one crack, batting.
Yeah.
Now, if you had a PR system, you could think in terms of changing things incrementally,
yeah,
bit by bit, persuading people about one thing and then moving on to the next thing. But because it's a first-past-the-post game, you've got to shut the right wing up in your own party, then you've got to bat, and then you've got to get everything you want through in one go.
Yeah.
Bang.
Okay.
And that's supposedly the advantage of first-past-the-post.
Yeah, yeah.
You, can get you know, you, the batties are batting, the fielders are fielding, everybody knows what they're supposed to be doing.
Mm.
But then that does lead to, it should lead, because that's the theory of it, to extremists being the people running the show on both sides. So people got a clear decision. You can have Thatcher or you can have Corbyn. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's your choice.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, you say they had one crack at it. They had one crack at it at the last election and they lost.
Well, no, because what happened was that Miliband wasn't the left. Yeah.
No, the last election, when Corbyn lost.
Oh, yeah, well, yes. Have you forgotten
that one, Martin?
No, yeah, I haven't forgotten that one. But the fact is, the left wing of the Labour Party, like me, would say, well, the reason we didn't do as well as we might have done that, i.e. by winning, is because the right wing had basically been sabotaging us for the previous 2 years. So there was just, if they'd just shut up and done as they were supposed to when Corbyn was first elected, we might have won.
I don't believe that for a second.
Well, I don't. You may not believe it, but you've got to remember that in the febrile atmosphere that has been developed since 2008, the Grillisti and the Lega del Nord have just won the election in Italy. They're both parties that were created after the crash.
Yeah.
Now, Lega del Nord's got an older history. But the mainstream parties have been trashed.
Mm.
And that's what's happening. People are beginning to realise that, what my granddad voted for is not necessarily what I'm going to be voting for.
Well, that had been happening in this country. If you look at the combined share of Labour plus Tory, for like the last 20 or 30 years, it's been gradually going down. The last election.
Yeah.
So, what's changed there?
Well, what changed there is that the Labour Party is starting to play... they're starting to play a hard game under the first-past-the-post rules. Blair, for example, as we mentioned earlier, did nothing about the renationalisation of the railways.
No.
For 13 years. You can understand, first term, you can't do everything.
Mm.
And what they said to the railway workers and the RMT and so on was, well, it might be an aspiration, but we can't afford it. It's too, we're not going to waste any money. Then the banks wobble and suddenly the checkbooks come out. Royal Bank of Scotland just gets endless amounts of taxpayer money. I mean, it's astonishing to me how quickly people have forgotten what underpins all of this, which is that the banks collapse and then the taxpayers bailed the banks out in defiance of the Thatcherite textbook.
Mm.
Proper Thatcherites would say they should go down.
Yeah.
But of course, if the banking system goes down, and this is capitalism, red in tooth and claw, that means a whole generation of people lose their savings.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what has to happen. And if you don't like that, you're not a capitalist.
No.
And if you want your savings to be protected, then you are, in fact, a socialist, whether you realise it or not.
Yes, indeed. But there is this this general thing that the government, in the event of a bank going under, the government will protect your savings up to, I think, about £80,000 per account, isn't it? So, if you let Royal Bank of Scotland go down, it's only the shareholders who lose out, isn't it?
Yeah, but the shareholders will include pension funds and things like this.
Mm.
And, of course, the knock-on effect, it's not just a bank going down. The thing was, it was a systemic risk.
Indeed,
the banking system will go down, and it probably will go down. There's a bank in Latvia which has just been closed down because it's supposedly money laundering, according to the Americans.
Yeah.
But it's a potentially systemically important bank. So, and we're still teetering on the brink here. People have got used to living in the last chance saloon with the financial services sector. And the reality is that we're talking about whether Labour or Tory should run, what we should spend our money on. There's quite possibly going to be a full-on banking collapse that will make 2008 look like a Sunday afternoon tea party.
Right.
And I hope the top civil service in the Treasury have got a plan. Because last time, they had to have Curry brought into number 10 while they sat up all night coming up with a plan.
Yeah, yeah.
If it happens again and there isn't a plan, heads must roll. There must be a nuclear option plan for something like this happening.
The Royal Bank of Scotland. So, I mean, are you saying then, I mean, it seems like you are saying that it was right to bail out the banks to keep them afloat.
Well, at the time, it's a problem for the people in charge to decide whether they're going to bail them out or not. What was wrong was that the Labour government here pushed for a bailout, which the American Republican Party bought. It was the Irish who first decided to underwrite their banks, which of course the Germans were very happy about because it was their banking system which was threatened by the Irish collapse. Then Gordon Brown was flying over the Atlantic when the Irish did that, and when he arrived in the US, he persuaded that we've got to bail the banks out. And of course, the alternative to bailing the banks out is let them collapse. And then, of course, you may have people saying, well, we don't want to go back to the way it was before. We're going to have a complete change of system here.
Mm.
Private sector banks finished. Yeah. Now, if you bail them out, you should then start telling them what to do. But, of course, what the new Labour did, the RBS was set up to be an arm's-length organisation. They were supposed to go on and act like a private bank trying to maximise their profits. And in order to get back to, so the whole idea was that having bailed the banks out, we just try to get them back to being in the private sector as soon as possible. And that's all we're doing here. And that's because there was a lack of ideological economic understanding at the high levels of the new Labour. Basically, were rather ignorant about economics. They were touchy feely schmoozy kind of people who thought that the basics of the capitalist economy were okay, and all we need to do is just put a nicer smiley face on it. Mm. And of course, it was wrong, fundamentally wrong. And, you know, Marxists like me, and there are still some people like me in the Labour Party, you've got to analyse capitalism. It isn't an unproblematic thing that we're just talking about how we can tweak it. It's actually it's a very revolutionary way of organising production. It leads to all sorts of massive social change, unpredictable social change. And that's the problem. It's not conservative at all. It's a revolutionary system. And people have got to constantly reinvent their lives with a capitalist society. You know, I mean, I used to work in Poland, for example, after the changes there. And people were, you know, they were hostile to the previous system. But it was very safe and comfortable. The three factories where I used to live in Lubartov, everybody used to have 2 weeks holiday a year.
Right.
And they would all get on the buses and go together to the seaside. And then they would come back. And their lives were very boring, but very secure.
Yeah.
And capitalism ain't like that. Nobody, you can't take anything for granted.
Okay, so we've reluctantly bailed out the banks. The Bank of England has imposed these sort of so-called stress tests that they put on the banks. I'm guessing you're going to say that they're not good enough.
It's window dressing.
Totally?
Not totally.
No.
I mean, you know, they haven't. But it's fun. The systemic risk is probably worse now because, and Austrian school free market economists would agree with me on this, because once you've bailed them out, they think, well, you know, if we mess up, then we're going to be bailed out. I mean,
yeah.
I was going to mention this the other week when we were on here. I mean, the guy who, there's a film called The Big Short about the guy who guessed correctly that the stock market was going to collapse.
Yeah.
And he used to work in a mainstream Wall Street firm, and he kept saying that, well, I'm going to bet on the stock market collapsing, it's going to collapse. And eventually his bosses said, well, you know, you're not on our team. So he went and set up his own company, bet on the stock market collapsing. And then, of course, in 2008, because he'd been for years and years and years betting on this, he made a fortune. he was, you know, he really made himself wealthy. Anyway, he wrote a book about it, and then he went to talk to his old line manager from the Wall Street bank or hedge fund or wherever he used to work, and he said he went to this meeting, and he said, oh, you've become famous now because you bet against the market and you've made yourself a multimillionaire. You're worth how much? And he said, well, I'm worth twice that for getting it wrong. So who's the mug here, me or you?
Yeah.
And that's the problem. Yeah.
Okay, but are there realistic changes that could be made then to the banking system that aren't revolutionarily socialist, which would be sort of acceptable?
Well, I mean, if you look at what's happened in Iceland, you know, what they did is they bailed out the depositors with Icelandic citizenship, because their argument was that the Icelandic banks had got loads of customers in the City of London, which is where they operated, and it was up to the City of London to regulate them, because they weren't really Icelandic at all. So they didn't bail out any foreign interests, and they didn't bail out the banks. They bailed out the depositors. They increased unemployment benefit. I mean, you've only got less people than in Bristol living in Iceland. Yeah. We all know we're going to be unemployed soon, so we're not going to decrease unemployment benefit. That'd be pretty stupid. That'll be us then. And it worked. I mean, what they did is they dumped a lot of the bad debt onto the British taxpayer, which is the only negative thing you can say about it.
Right.
Because it didn't really solve all the problems.
No.
But it worked a lot better than what we've done. And the Irish bailed out their banks, who are massively, you know, they've got massive interests all over the world. The British banking system is still worth several times the British national product. So, I mean, just imagine, they trade all over the world, they've got interests all over the world, and we've got to bail. See, the creation of multinational banks is always a multinational, but the resolution of their bankruptcy is always done by national states.
Yeah. Royal Bank of Scotland has posted profits. The first year, I think, it's actually produced a profit of 750. This was last year, actually, the profit, but obviously, they're just recently, the figures have just come out. And the bank is still 71% owned by the government. So, you know, are we going to get our money back, or should we just hang on there? Or
well, we're not going to get our money back. I think that's pretty clear,
right?
And that's the point. And of course, that's not actually added to the British national debt. All the money that's been pumped into the banking system is taken off the books because we're going to get it back. Except we're not. So, in other words, what's happened is that capitalism functions under a sort of free market, free for all philosophy until it crashes, and then the state comes in and bails it all out. But what you've got to recognise at that point, the ideology of capitalism is simply gone. There isn't one. The current distribution of wealth in Britain, for example, is nothing to do with the market forces. It's to do with political decisions to bail out certain groups and not others. Yeah. And therefore, of course, there's no market reason why we should accept that distribution of wealth. That wealth doesn't belong to the people who think that it belongs to them. They only have it because of political decisions. And therefore, there's no market reason why we can't take it off them. Yeah, there's no market reason for the super wealthy who've made money out of the crisis, and they have. That's our money that they've got. And that's true in a market sense. Are you following me? We're not just talking about ultimate ideological sense.
Right.
That money, which is our money, and we want it back, basically.
So how practically might you go about doing that, though?
Well, you'd have needed a consensus at the moment in the after crash scenario, where everybody, you know, realised that we can't go on like this and we've got to change the show.
Mm.
But the problem with bailing out, and this is the argument against bailing out any industry as put forward by Milton Friedman, is it's not just a one-off. You bail out an industry, a steel industry, a car industry, a coal industry, a shipbuilding industry, a financial services industry, and it ain't a one-off.
Yeah.
They keep coming back for more.
Yeah. Well, there is some truth in that, isn't there?
There is. I mean, there is.
You look at
and that, what's happened is that the financial services classes have been bailed out.
Yeah.
And not only are they not grateful, they're actually rather arrogant about the whole thing. And their power is more than it was before. You know, Mirofsky is a US academic who's written extensively about this. And they've been very, very successful in diverting people's anger onto homeless people and, you know, disabled people and migrants, when the actual truth of the matter is, the the masters of the universe who did this have not only been punished, they've been rewarded. Yeah. They are better off today as a result of the policies that have been pursued. All the growth and wealth has gone to the 1% and the 0.1%, and they've got away with it.
Yeah. Let's raise the subject of another bailout which happened recently. It didn't really, did it? Carillion went bust. The Guardian reports that basically the government missed a chance to save it, or missed several chances to save it. There's a bailout scheme, or a way of saving the firm, was devised by accounting firm Ernst & Young, but the government would not enforce it. Now, is that incompetence on the government's part, or is that actually them taking your advice and saying, let them fail?
Well, I don't know enough about the detail to be firm in my view. I could give general views about it rather than saying what should they have done or not done. I think the real problem is that these outsourcing what should be state activities to these exposes you to this kind of risk.
Right.
If you think about the collapse of Southern Cross some years ago, which was a...
You'll have to remind me, what did they do?
They looked after old folks in old people's homes. And, of course, they went bankrupt. Then the government had to step in and sort it all out. Now, I would argue that there are certain things which shouldn't be exposed to market forces. Now, Carillion building stuff, okay, not everything can be run by direct labour controlled by the government, but why are they running school meals?
Yeah.
Why are they running, all of this kind of, social infrastructure stuff? That shouldn't be. And, of course, if that was all run by local authorities or whatever, then there'd be no danger of it going bankrupt and all the consequences, etc.
Mm.
I mean, people are involved in high-risk sort of construction projects. Well, they go bankrupt.
But school meals is pretty low-risk, though, isn't it? So
that's why they shouldn't be doing it.
Right.
That should just be done by... it shouldn't be done for a profit, and in actual fact you can imagine lots of things not being done for a profit. If all education and all healthcare were free, that's a substantial chunk of the economy.
Mm.
Very substantial, probably from a third to a half, if not more. And then if you were to take a step from that and say, well, if we're going to have free healthcare, why have pharmaceutical companies making massive markups on the stuff they sell the NHS? So then you nationalise the pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah.
And pretty soon you'd have what would... And then the banks collapsed. So you then have, like in Iceland, they've now got state-owned banking. That's what they've got.
Yeah.
Back to state-owned banking.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, what's the private sector? Well, it's a few bits and bobs. And in the 1920s, the co-ops, the cooperative shops, were so powerful that they were wiping out the rest of retail. And therefore, there were changes made in company law because they had particular advantages because they were mutual. Taxes were different.
Okay, right.
Yeah, they weren't taxed in the same way as other retail. And you could imagine a... where the private sector really would just be a few bits and bobs. You don't want to go out of your way to kill off entrepreneurialism.
No.
But if you're going to come up with a better widget, go away and come up with a better widget. Everything else is already run, on a different basis.
Mm.
And I think, the kind of mixed economy I would like to see would be predominantly public sector and third sector with a residual private sector. And I think that's where we're going to end up. Because if you look at the history of industrialised economies over centuries, the public sector does get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, which is what drives the right-wing bonkers. But, of course, it does because society becomes more sophisticated, more caring, more worthwhile. We don't just have kids sleeping in the street. Somebody does try to educate them and so on. And that's the public sector grows.
Yeah.
And it's not parasitic on the private sector. The private sector also can grow they're going about what they call crowding out, that if the public sector does it, then the private sector should concentrate on what the private sector's for, creating new innovative products, new stuff,
right?
Not the old stuff, the new stuff.
On the subject of co-ops there, even if they're subject to the same tax regime as the private sector, they have an advantage in that they're not paying dividends, of course.
Well, the co-op does pay dividends
in theory,
the customers.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they're consumer co-ops.
But nonetheless, surely that gives them an economic advantage.
It does.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things in the 1920s, the Retail Services Federation or whatever it was at the time was lobbying the Tory government to say, you've got to do something about the co-op shops because they're going to wipe us out. Right. I saw this happen in Lubartov when I lived in Poland. Small town, 27,000 people, and the three factories closed. And what a lot of people did to adapt to the new circumstances, they set up little shops. So when I first arrived there in the mid-90s, there were lots and lots of little shops. Then the co-op Spoem got some trainers in from the West.
Yeah.
And also Macro arrived and places like, and before you know it, all these little shops are out of business because, you know, more organized retail had turned up, including Spoem, which was the traditional cooperative shops,
right,
which had been run by the government, and they're actually rubbish. When I first arrived, you go into Spoem, this went to the woman, they would like to buy some milk. And she was saying, well, it's in the fridge. So we'll just go and get it. I don't want to go in the fridge. It's freezing in there. You know, it's like, you know, you just don't get the whole thing about retail, do you?
No.
But of course, once they were trained, their buying capacity was bigger than all these little shops. And what happens is people adapt once to what they think are new circumstances, and then they have to. That's not good enough. You've got to adapt again. That's what I was saying about capitalism being a constant process of people just running to stand still.
Yeah. Let's go back to, you've said many times on many different shows about how you're confident that the banks are going to collapse, or that, you know, the euro is going to collapse, whatever.
Well,
Bill
Gates was saying that this very week.
Right, right. But I mean, have you got bets on any of these?
Why not? Because I've got no money. Okay. And gambling is a sin, I suppose. But the thing is that predicting when it's going to happen is a mug's game.
Hmm.
For two reasons. A, because it's very hard. You never know when the camel's back is going to be breached, as it were. And the other thing is, it may well be a deliberate act at some point. By the powers that be, you know, they decide to crash it when they're ready to suit another agenda,
right,
which is to do with warfare, geopolitics, and things like that. And so, if you get mixed up in that, you're trying to bet against the people who are rigging. They are rigging the market. The Prince Protection Team piled into the markets the other week to prop it up.
Yeah.
That's what most people believe who are serious about markets. Now, you can't bet against people. If the government is going to intervene in the market to try and prop it up, you betting against that is a bit of a mug's game, isn't it?
George Soros succeeded, though, didn't he?
Well, he did, but he succeeded on that occasion because it was an open goal. I think what may happen if this Brexit stuff starts to become really iffy, as it looks as if it will,
yeah,
is people like Soros will short the pound, and at that point the government will be forced to raise interest rates to protect the currency, at which point the stock market and the property market collapses.
Yeah.
And if that happens in Britain, without it happening everywhere else, it'll be pretty clear to the population what the cause of it is.
Yeah.
But what I fear will happen is it will be part of a general collapse of the Eurozone, the US, and therefore the Brexit aspect of it will not really strike home. But I think this is the thing that really annoys me about Brexit is we spent years and years and years now talking about this, and what we really should have been talking about, what we're talking about now, which is the banking system and so on.
Yeah.
I mean, people talk about Greece. Greece, if Greece had defaulted, as Varoufakis suggested, Deutsche Bank would have been smashed. That's the main bank in Germany, would have
right.
gone down the drain. Now, if the main bank in Germany goes down the drain, then Barclays goes down the drain, HSBC goes down the drain.
Yeah.
And that's what the Greeks, or Varoufakis, was threatening. And that's what most people don't realise, is that this is a game of chicken. Now, if Varoufakis has been able to push his view through in the Greek cabinet, they basically bottled it.
Right, yeah? Right.
Because it's, you know, pressing that button is just too scary.
Right.
And you can see why people do bottle it. Yeah. What are we, you know, we're going to bring the whole damn thing down.
Yeah.
And we've now reached a point where political decisions like that are going to determine when and how this crash happens. See, the Federal Reserve have been tightening quantitative easing over the last few months, and the stock market has started to wobble.
Okay.
And what have they done? They've stopped tightening. Or perhaps we better just stop doing that. And they can always carry on printing money. And then in actual fact, there's a psychology developed in the markets now that as long as they are prepared to print money, then it's all going to be wonderful. Whoopee!
Yeah. How do you print money and avoid inflation? Because those are the sort of two things.
Well, you've got fundamentally deflationary forces at work.
Right. Yeah. Right, okay.
The whole Chinese working class, the Eastern Europe. Turns up in the global economy, forcing wage rates down. We've now got a situation where the British economy is growing, but wage rates are just stagnant because the balance of power in the labour market's completely changed. Yeah,
right.
People just feel grateful to have a job these days. Never mind where's my money. You know that. I mean, back in the 60s and the 70s, people would say, well, you know, where's our raise? You know, where's our extra money? You know, we expect it year on year. That's not been happening for a long time.
Yeah,
there could be hyperinflation in the end because they're printing so much money, and if there's a crash of the dollar, then all these dollars will flood back into the US. They could have hyperinflation.
Mm. We've got about 40 seconds to talk about this. We might have to leave it till round two, as it were, Martin.
Yeah. Can't get much done in 40 seconds.
We can't get much done in 40 seconds. So what we're going to have to do then is just look ahead. So after the news, well, after what would be the news, after the traditional news break, where we the satellite's broken, if you're wondering what's going on. We won't be able to bring you the news, I'm afraid. We could just invent some fake news. It's all fake anyway, but after the news break, not surprisingly, we'll be talking about Russians and Salisbury and Brexit, and there's loads and loads of stuff. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Politics Show. I'm Steve Satan. That man over there is Martin Summers for the last week before Tony comes back next week.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.